Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick. The podcast where each episode I sit down with a different guest as we discuss their career and unwrap a story on the worst gift they've ever been given. Joining me on this week's show is stand-up comedian Deliso Chaponda. Deliso stops by to discuss his career in comedy, his amazing run on Britain's Got Talent, and of course, he lets me in on the worst gift he's ever been given. Well, Deliso, it's so great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming by.
Pleasure, James. Thank you so much for having me.
Really looking forward to finding out more about you and your career. But Deliso, I understand your early life was spent in a number of different countries. Talk me through it.
I was born in Zambia. But the thing is, we're Malawian refugees.
Ah.
And refugees can't go home. So My early life was Zambia, Somalia, Kenya, Swaziland, Austria, Switzerland, France, Malaysia, Thailand. It was all over the place. Over the place. I was a nomad. Well, because my dad went from being a refugee to becoming a diplomat. So we were always nomads. Oh. My radio show is called Citizen of Nowhere. And The reason is that.
Yes.
I didn't just pick the name because Theresa May had done a speech about, I don't know if you remember this, Theresa May did a speech which was something like, person who is a citizen of the world is a citizen of nowhere. And so her doing that and me also realizing that I grew up everywhere made me think Citizen of Nowhere. That's the show.
So growing up in all of those countries, you must have been able to experience a number of different cultures at quite an early age.
As a kid, you don't realize it's odd, right?
Yeah.
You just travel from place to place, meet new people, have new experiences. But as you get older, when you start comparing notes with other people, that's when you realize, oh, I'm a weirdo. Like everybody else has friends they've had since they were kids. They don't change friends every year like me. Everybody else has favorite foods which are of one country as opposed to being a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of this. Most people can speak two languages well or one language well. I speak little bits of many languages. So it was that where I started to realize, oh, this isn't normal. But until you get a little older, you're just growing up and accepting it.
I guess also when it came to you writing material when you started comedy, I know a lot of comedians have to maybe adapt material when they perform in different countries or different locations. I guess for you, you were able to pull from a lot of sort of real life experiences from all of those different cultures.
Yes, I've also noticed that I always explain in my jokes. And I think this is something that happens because I've always traveled. I would never assume everyone has the common experience of me. So you'll sometimes see a comedian do a joke about pasties or about being on the tube. And that's clearly someone who they take it for granted that all of their audience is going to know what they're talking about, while I never assume that. And so I'll often, in how I'm telling stories, inbuild explaining what certain terms are.
And in terms of your comedy, before we go on to you performing, when did your interest in comedy begin?
I was always funny. I realized funny was a superpower very early. I had never seen stand-up, but I wrote funny poems. I was like the funny kid in class who says funny things. And I just learned that very quickly. And also I loved like Roald Dahl. I loved George Bernard Shaw. Whenever literature classes or any classes jumped into comedy, I was like, ooh, this, I love this. And it was only much later as at university, I discovered stand-up, but it was one of those like, oh, that's me. That's why I've been this all my life. The closest I came to stand-up before stand-up comedy was I used to be in debate club.
Ah, yes.
In high school. But while other people argued with logic, I would argue by mocking the arguments of my opponents and getting big laughs. And that was interesting. It was a kind of stand-up.
And you mentioned university there, and I know you went to university in Canada, and I understand that's where your comedy journey really began.
Yes, because there was a little pub. There was a little pub with a comedy club in a function room at the top called The Comedy Works. And I went over to one. I was doing all kinds of open mics. I knew I wanted to be artistic. I didn't know how. So I was doing poetry open mics, and I was doing fiction open mics and all sorts. And one of them was a comedy open mic. And so I wrote a funny rap about training for the ladies. I can't believe I still remember it, but a funny rap called Training for the Ladies, and a funny poem about, it was like a love poem, a bad love poem. And then as that worked, I watched other people do stand up, and I started actually writing jokes and trying out actual comedy. So yeah, that's the genesis.
The genesis. So you're in Canada, and then at what point did you then come over to the UK?
So after graduating, I tried to stay in Canada to the point that I even put on a show called Don't Let Them Deport Me. I wasn't allowed to stay. So I went to Ethiopia, did a little internship there. I went to South Africa, tried to do comedy there. I went to Malawi. And only after trying in these places did I then come to the UK. Because I had a brother who lived here, I was able to get a little temporary visa.
Uh-huh.
Then I was able to use that to get an agent. And then I moved to the UK. And that was the first time I was a professional comedian, because I was living off it, even though really I was living in my brother's spare room. So I was just earning enough to travel and eat.
So, of course, many people listening will know you from Britain's Got Talent back in 2017.
Yes.
Golden buzzer act. We have to say third place and a golden buzzer. You did incredibly well. What do you remember?
It was fantastic.
What do you remember of that experience? Did you go into that competition thinking, I've got a real shot here?
No, not at all. I went in thinking that I would get a nice video clip, mm-hmm. which I could use to get corporates. And that was all that I was aiming for, because I was like, look, I'm not going to get through. I'm a little too controversial. I'm old. I'm not old, but, you know, I mean, for Britain's Got Talent, I'm old, because I was like, you know, they're 7-year-olds. They're the ones who are going to light up and get people clapping. So I just went on as like, I'm going to do okay. I'm funny enough to do okay. I'll have a nice professional video, which I can send to all these companies, and I'll get a few more corporates. That was all that I expected. Wow. And then when I did the audition and got the golden buzzer, it was insane. I could not sleep that night. I was so excited. And when it aired, I had done a little bit of television before. I had done a thing called World Stands Up. I had done little things, and I did not realize how much of a different level Britain's Got Talent was. The day the golden buzzer audition aired, my phone, I had to turn off my phone from so many people calling me. It was crazy, absolutely crazy. And then the next morning, I walk around outside and I step out of my flat. And again, I'm recognized by one person, and little kids like, it's you. And I was just like, this is crazy. I could not fathom what 100 million people watching you looks like.
No.
Because the YouTube clip got like 100 million, and you cannot actually tangibly imagine that until you get off a flight on the other side of the world, right? Like, I'll do a show in Rwanda, I'll come off the plane, and the guy unloading the bags is like, oh, it's you! It's really bizarre. It's really bizarre and fantastic.
Have you got used to that, though, as the years have gone on? Have you got used to that?
I've got used to it. To be fair, the insane time was the 6 months after doing it.
Yeah.
Now I get recognized maybe 2 times a day, and it might be from Britain's Got Talent, or it might be from one of the things that Britain's Got Talent has led to. Mm-hmm. So, for example, someone recognized me yesterday from Royal Variety.
Ah, yes.
But I probably wouldn't have done the Royal Variety if I hadn't done Britain's Got Talent a few years ago. Or they'll recognize you from QI. And again, it's like, it was the ripple effect. It started the ripple effect.
Absolutely. I had a question about Britain's Got Talent, but I don't know if you're gonna be able to tell me, if it's like an industry secret, but
I'll answer everything.
Amazing. I was interested to know how much creative control, if you like, you had over your material in those later rounds as you got to the live shows.
Okay, so I will say this. They were very permissive, but they would tell you what you can't do.
Okay.
Right? So they pretty much let after going back and forth with them a few rounds, on the early rounds, this is what I realized I always need to do. Give them too many jokes, and they say, no, 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 and then I will build a set out of the rest of the jokes.
Okay.
So if I was doing 5 minutes, I would send them 10 minutes of options. And they'll be like, oh, no, you can't do that about Theresa May. That's a little bit religious and offensive. But they didn't tell me what to say. They just said, definitely not that.
Okay.
And then from what was left, I made the best set that could be. The only time it got a little hectic was the final. And that was partly my own fault because I didn't know if I'd make the final. So actually, I've never told anyone this. I didn't know I'd make the final. And so I was talking with my agent and they were like, you just have to get to the final. Don't save anything for the final, right? Because you could be kicked out anyway. So yeah. You just have to get to the final because Britain's Got Talent competitor will get you a bit of work. Britain's Got Talent finalist will get you lots of work.
Yes.
Right? And I was very realistic. I was like, I'm not going to win the whole thing. So I just have to get to the final. So I burnt all my best stuff. I watch it now, and it's really interesting. I watch that final, and I'm like, it's a semifinal. I could have stopped halfway, and I still would have gone through because it was going so well. But I was like, everything. This is the last time I'm going to be on television with this many people. Every joke I've got, here you go. And then I was like, oh, no, I've got 2 days. It was one of these unlucky things where there were only 2 days between our final. I did a Friday, and then Sunday was the final.
No.
To make a set for the final. And I've burnt all the best stuff. So then I send them the second best stuff. And then of the second best stuff, they're like, you can't do that, and you can't do that, and you can't do that. And then I was like, what can I do? And that was the stressful time. But it was partly created by my own guns blazing, throw everything at it. But actually, to this day, when other comedians call me for advice, I tell them the same thing. You'll probably not make the final, so burn it all. Yeah. Just burn it all. Most of my work I get now is from that semifinal performance because that was the viral one. So it was the right thing to do.
Talking in material leads me quite nicely onto my next question, which was around sort of your opinion on how the world around us sort of has evolved. And you talking about maybe writing material when, you know, Britain's Got Talent said to you, oh, you can't say that, or you can't say that. Do you find now that audiences have changed as the world changes around us, and maybe things you could have said, say, 7 or 8 years ago, you now can't get away with saying?
I'll tell you the interesting thing is I see it very differently from a lot of British comedians who have seen a change. Because I perform all around the world, I've always known that there are some things you can say in one culture and some things you can't say in another culture. Right?
Yeah.
So when I'm doing a show in Dubai, I'm not going to talk about God.
No.
I'm not going to do filth. When I am in Zimbabwe, I'm not going to talk about the government. Right? So I've always adapted to the audience and what's acceptable. And even in the UK, people never realized there were things which people didn't want to do. Not necessarily that I'd want to do it, but like, you're not going to open your set with a Princess Diana joke. Even 10 years ago, there's always a matter of what is acceptable to the people in front of you. Now, because of like, you know, social justice movements and the world trying to be a bit more, and every generation does it in a different way, but because of the world trying to be considerate in a certain way, there are certain things that you could have done 10 years ago, which can still be done, but are frowned upon. Like, you know, if you want to do jokes about a minority group, be it like a trans group or like an ethnic group, that's not something you can do necessarily in the UK. You can do it. You just have to be very clever, but you can't do a simple joke about it the way you could 10 years ago, right? But that's just the new reality. But, you know, 20 years ago, yes, Roy Chubby Brown could be racist and say all kinds of dodgy stuff in his jokes, but you couldn't do a straight sex joke on prime time the way you see now. So I think it's always shifting and always changing. So I'm always like, I just adapt to what I've got in front of me right now. So right now I talk about whatever I want to do, but I just rewrite it. And I'll tell you what the crazy thing is. I actually feel, you know, these people who feel like they can't perform right now because of the subject matter, I could rewrite their joke so they could do it. I'm confident I could rewrite their joke because I think you can talk about anything. You just have to change how you go into it, you know, just kind of build the logic in a way that makes it acceptable. I'll give you a perfect example. So Britain's Got Talent said to me, I had a joke, which was 200 years ago, this would have been an auction. Okay. And they said to me, you can't do that joke. It's too negative. It's, you know, this is a show with kids watching and so on. You can't do that joke. So I said, okay, give me 1 second. And then I went to a pub and I filmed myself saying, we've come so far. Women can vote. You know, we've got Wi-Fi. 200 years ago, this would have been an auction. And it was the same joke, but I turned it into a celebration of how far we've come. Uh-huh. And when I sent it to them and it was no longer critical, they're like, oh, you can do it. And it's because I realized their issue was it wasn't the content. Their issue was this is a bit cynical and negative for a prime time thing with little kids watching. So I always think you can just change how you do jokes and make them acceptable.
Incredible. And talking of new material, you are back out on the road, my friend, with a brand new tour. Apocalypse Not Now is the title.
Yes.
Tell us
a
little bit about the show and where people can find you.
Yes. So it's an obvious genesis.
Yes.
We have all gone through what seemed to be a possible apocalypse, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic. It felt like the end of the world. Nothing is ever going to be the same. And I was sitting at home, lonely, worried that I'm going to die. Other people are going to die. It's just, this is the end of the world. And then it's the realizing, okay, this is not the apocalypse. This is not the end of the world, but it is a big change. So it's talking about what I went through in the pandemic, but then also other big changes in my life. You know, like there was a time when my dad was arrested. So I talk about that. I talk about, you know, the craziest relationship of my life. So it's all about change because apocalypse actually means, oh, sorry, I may be wrong. Catastrophe, I believe, actually just means big change. Uh-huh. So the show became Big Change. And then Apocalypse was just, it's a nice pun.
And almost another apocalypse at the moment, at the time we're recording this, in regards to petrol prices as well.
Petrol!
And availability
indeed,
of petrol.
Availability of petrol. Now, this is all new for the British, but like 2010, Malawians, we did it first. Right? We did it first. Not only did we do it first, we did it better. We had like no petrol. So people were selling jerrycans of petrol in the black market. Everybody had WhatsApp groups, which would car share, and you'd sort of join the WhatsApp group and saying, I'm going there and I'm going there, and you'd all car share. The UK is not there yet. Now, if it keeps going for 2-3 weeks, you guys will start doing stuff like that. But you're not yet at the point where you're siphoning from other people's cars. But if these times come, I'm ready, okay? They should actually contact me. If there's ever a fuel crisis again, just contact Deliso. I've got the experience from Malawi. I can teach you people.
You can head the whole thing up. You can project manage the whole thing.
Exactly. It's also things like when, it's amazing how people in the UK, I think whenever there's a crisis or disruption, be it when there was like power cuts or people go from zero to, oh no. Well, I feel in places like Malawi, where this sort of thing happens, it's just sort of like you adapt. You're like, okay, what are we going to do? Okay. You know, do we all start using public transport? Do we all start, what do we do? And that's very much I would say African, but the poor places in Africa perspective. Bad things happen, you adapt.
The other big one in the UK, obviously, is snow as well. We completely overreact whenever
a
single drop of snow
hits. From someone who lived in Canada, I don't understand what people are talking about here. We used to have like absurd amounts of snow in Canada. I remember walking from the university residence to the train station was maybe 200 meters. By the time I did it, there would be icicles in my beard. That's cold.
I also wanted to touch on your daily crowdsourced comedy show that you did during the during the lockdown. Over 200 shows you did, the Corona Cast.
Yes.
How did you
find
that?
Yes, the Corona Cast. I would still be doing it. You know that.
Yeah.
If it had started making money, I would have. But it never did. So just to check, did you live alone or did you live with someone during pandemic?
So here's the funny story. Me and my partner, we moved in together to our first house the week before the lockdown hit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so wow. I mean, we were really forced together. I mean,
really forced together.
The fact we are still together is sort of a testament to our relationship, because
I'm
pretty sure she'd have killed me. You know,
A lot of people broke up seeing the same person every day. But I wish I had that. I was alone, all alone and depressed in lockdown. And then to keep myself going, I started doing this CoronaCast. I started doing a stream every day where I wrote a show. And it was halfway between a radio show and stand-up show, and that it was funny, but it wasn't just 30 minutes of gags, right? Yeah. It would be, I'd ruminate on something, then I'd do a gag. Then I'd ruminate on something, then I'd do a gag. And it was just like a thing which I did thinking, this is going to be 3 weeks of lockdown, right?
Yeah, so, like we all did.
But then once I'd started, it was really interesting. It's very hard to stop. I'm that sort of person who, if this is what I'm doing now, I'm going to do it till the end of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But then it was only after like near episode 200, I was like, this thing is not ending. And I've not managed to start making money from it. I mean, I made like probably through the whole lockdown, I probably made £600 of it from people donating and so on. But I mean, this is 200 episodes. Yeah, what's the average? £3 an episode? Yeah. No. So it was one of those things I had thought it was going to build. I thought it was going to get an audience. And you can't control that, because they're friends of mine who I know who started podcasts and it caught fire somehow. And then they got, you know, millions of viewers. And then there are other people who had really clever podcasts, which don't. It's that same thing as comedy.
Yeah.
The TV comics aren't necessarily the best comics. There's a little, there's talent. They're all talented. There's talent, there's work ethic, but then there's also some kismet. There's some unpredictable magic, like me happening to do Britain's Got Talent on the day when they'd been in all day. The act before me was atrocious. And then I walk on and do well. And all of those things help. Maybe if the act before me was great, I still would have done well, but I wouldn't have got the buzzer. There's a lot of, sometimes there's a bit of luck. And so for the podcast, a little bit of luck never happened. So it was useful to do, kept my sane, made me a better joke writer because I wrote more jokes in those 200 days than I've ever written. But at the same time, I had to stop it when I was like, I need to do something that pays the bills.
Denisa, we reached the part of the show where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
Okay, now this needs context.
Okay.
Because when I tell you the gift, it's going to sound wonderful. So I got a bicycle.
Okay.
I got a bicycle. I believe I was 9 years old. I was 8 or 9. When I was living in Kenya, my parents gave me a new bicycle for my birthday. Seems good. Now let me explain why it wasn't. My family brought me up to be very religious, right? They took me to church all the time. I used to do Sunday school all the time. I was very religious to the point that I wanted to be a reverend.
Uh-huh.
Now, all that's been bashed in my head at all of these churches that my parents sent me to is charity and being good to other people and, you know, not being selfish and so on. Now, in this context, I get given a brand new bike. Now, there's a little boy who walks to school and passes our house every day. So he walks to school a long time. I'm talking to this guy and, you know, like I get driven to school. I'm much more privileged than this kid. So I gave him my bike.
What a nice guy. Okay.
I gave him my bike and I got in such trouble for giving away an expensive bike, and also I never heard the end of it. It was constantly, to this day, brought up at dinner parties. Deliso gave away his bike. I was punished, and it became this constant thing which is brought up all the time when I was just doing what they raised me to do. And, you know, they don't give terms and conditions when reading the Bible. They should probably do that. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, you know, turn the other cheek. Terms and conditions apply. Not if someone punches you in a pub, okay? Or like, you know, give away to the needy, but not if it is a gift which your parents slaved away to be able to afford and give you. Terms and conditions apply. So that's the worst gift I got, even though it was great, because it led to such repercussions.
Delisso, wrapping up, I have a couple of questions I ask everybody that comes onto this show. So if you could if you could go back to your childhood and rescue a gift you don't have now, maybe even that bike, what would you go back and rescue?
Interesting. If I could go back and rescue a gift, it would probably be, it's so funny. I had this remote control car, which I absolutely loved. And just for nostalgia's sake, it would be cool to have. Not that I would be out there playing with it, but it would be nice to have and be like, tell people this was the first remote control car. I love it. Yeah, that would be it.
And if you could go back to the beginning of your comedy career and give yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you go back and give yourself?
I would go back and I would tell myself that it's going to work out.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Like, just hold on till 2017, right? I'm not going to tell you how, but something's going to happen. Because there were so many moments of doubt, so many moments of, should I have done this? It would have really helped to know, don't worry, we've got something. But then at the same time, if we look at the study of time travel and science fiction, me telling myself that would have created enough ripples that maybe I would have stayed a failure. So maybe it's better not to go back and give yourself a warning.
And finally, Delisso, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
AfricanComedian.com. I bought it first. It's also DelissoChaponda.com, but I know that people will forget Delisso Chaponda, so it's AfricanComedian.com. All the details about Apocalypse Not Now are there. You can also just check with your local theater. There's a free special of mine on Amazon Prime. If you've got Amazon Prime, check it out. It's 90 minutes of my best jokes, What the African Said. So that's the free thing. And then for the people who want to give me money, find Apocalypse Not Now and come watch it.
Fantastic. Delisso, it's been great to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by the show.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.